If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart.
Hi, everybody. Happy Mother's Day. Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, on WGN. I am playing Sinatra tonight. Sinatra and Count Basie, a CD is We Might As Well Be Swing, because it's spring outside. And Pat Collender, my guest for this first hour, the author of True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago, is an old friend of mine. We hail from kind of the same era. She was a great, great newspaper journalist, a great writer and reporter at the Tribune, and then moved on to all sorts, all manner. I've just stayed here forever. She's moved on to all manner of other things. This collection, Pat Collender, is mostly pieces written for the reader.
Yeah, mostly written for the reader. A few were, like I explained in the introduction, one was a failed book proposal on the Tylenol murders. And we now know the end to many of these stories that we didn't know.
Well, but it for me, it is to my mind, an essential book for any of those of you who relish great Chicago stories. It is in the, to my mind, it's in the famous footsteps of someone like in New York, Joseph Mitchell. And that's very, very, very high praise.
Thank you.
You write in this book, everyone was a fugitive back in my world growing up in the 60s. You grew up on the South Side, and you really do mean that. I mean, and it brought back those times to me too, Pat. It was a strange and bizarre. It was brought back when, during the whole, this piece the Tribune ran a couple Sundays ago about the Richard Speck murders. It evoked.
Right.
It was as interesting a time to grow up as I could even imagine.
Well, there were so many other kids our age. You know, on our block we had, you know, maybe 35 kids. And it was lower middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jewish kids moved to Skokie. The Mexican kids moved to Pilsen. And the rest of us, the Irish wanted to go to South Shore, which was sort of one neighborhood up.
Sure.
And that's what we were looking for.
What did your parents do?
Oh, my father was an auto mechanic. My mother was, well, she was a housewife.
Sure.
We had six kids. I was the oldest kid.
How were you and when were you drawn to writing? Not just, you know, you get imbued with some of the stories you write in the introduction. It was never possible to avoid madness, drug addiction, alcoholism, violence, anger, or stupidity by moving to another neighborhood or another city. That's the world in which we were. You obviously were drawn to stories. It's a big leap from stories to being able to tell stories with the passion and joy and expertise that you do. How were you drawn to telling stories?
Well, I think when you and I were on the street as 20-year-olds, you know, it was, comedy was the value system. I mean, if you could make other people laugh in the bars, that was like really the best thing that could ever happen to you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people entertained in the bars. Roger Ebert was one of the best.
One of the best. Bruce Elliott is still at it. John McHugh.
Yeah.
Even Mike Royko could be entertaining when he was of a mind. You went to the University of Illinois in Champaign. Did you study journalism down there?
Yes, I did.
Why?
But I had switched.
Why?
I had switched from drama. And I wanted to.
You would have been an amazing actress, Pat Collender. You would have been
I've had astrologers tell me that. I said I should
the
have
The blown
been in
opportunity
that
of your life.
But I thought, well, if I really want to be an actress, I should be in New York, right? You know, so I'll be a writer. in
well, but those, I mean, you know, too, even working for the papers in the 70s, late 60s and into the 70s in Chicago was a great time to be nurtured as an actor. You studied journalism. Why, Pat?
Because I would have a profession, you know, then I could maybe make a living, you know, which a big maybe, but it was a way to make a living as a writer that was legitimate in my family, and
they backed
that's
you in
why
this.
I wanted you're... a craft, you know, yeah. I wanted a job.
But also at the time, I mean, a Catholic girl growing up in the south part of the city, there were generally many parents, and I'm not trying to generalize, but many parents would have said, Pat, why don't you get a degree in education? You
know what I mean? Or nursing.
Yes.
Those were the two choices.
Were they behind you getting a journalism degree? Or?
Well, my father died when I was 16, so that left my mother with five other kids to worry about and really not pay much attention, you know, to what was going on.
Yeah.
And so I kind of did what I wanted to do, and I was lucky enough to sort of make a career out of it.
Well, you get out of college. You obviously, as one does, applies to various newspapers. The traditional route is to get a job at some small little paper in the middle of Wisconsin or Nebraska or Iowa or Missouri. You, however, Pat Callender, wind up getting a job at the Chicago Tribune. You must have been beside yourself.
I guess. When you're in college, you think you're pretty cool. And you think there's no discrimination against women. You know, you think you get a lot of ideas in college.
Before we take a first break, and I'm keeping Pat Callender here for the whole hour because we have a lot to talk about in Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and other true tales of love and death in Chicago. Did you, even in the early 70s, when late 60s, early 70s, that was not – newspapers were still really pretty much male bastions,
absolutely,
weren't they?
Absolutely. There was a picture on the wall in the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune, and there's no women in it. And one of my fellow women reporters at the time, who was also very young, said, oh, they all had their period that day.
Oh, how funny. How funny. You made a great mark. I'm curious why, and I don't know. Pat and I have known each other. Certainly not intimately, but we have known each other and have a million friends in common for 40 years, for 40 some years
and
their
least.
Stuff. I didn't even know she was from the South Side, but you have to love a person who can write and feel this as she does in the introduction. I'll be done with the introduction. Treating a person as though he or she is invisible or inferior is unacceptable behavior in human beings. That is, shares the Kogan philosophy. We'll be right back.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything.
I'm playing Sinatra tonight. This is a CD called It Might As Well Be Swing, Count Basie and Frank Sinatra. Why, I don't know. Pat Callender, who gave up a career as an actress to be a journalist, and good for, sad for the theater world, but great for the world of literature, because her book, a collection that came out a while ago, but is as fresh as yesterday, Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago, published by those geniuses at Eckhart's Press. Rick Camphor, one of those geniuses, is in here, and we'll get him to say something a little later. Pat, when you the decision to gather these stories, you had a lot to pick from. Why these?
I think there's stories that stay with you. And the Gian Grandi story was when I heard the first episode of Serial, Sarah Koenig,
sure,
NPR, I thought I really have to write the rest of that story and say what happened at the end, because it was my first reasonable doubt story. And she said, had said on the air, that Adnan's story was her case, you know.
Well, that
is. And you do feel that personally.
Sure. Did you rework any of these? I mean,
oh, all of them.
Yeah, because I see updates and all sorts of stuff in here. She's gotten amazing jacket quotes from actor-screenwriter Tim Kazurinsky, screenwriter and talented journalist Denise DeClue, Vicky Quadi, who's a playwright. And one of the great sort of understated jacket quotes in history, Bruce Elliott, he's the geriatric genius blogger, and the he has a book, Last Night at the Old Town Ale House, and he is now too famous for words, thanks to Anthony Bourdain spending his entire trip to Chicago in the ale house. Here, it's one of the great jacket quotes. It just is so Bruce. Pat Callender dropped off the manuscript of her book the other day. She has put together a collection of her very best work from the 70s and early 80s. These stories age well. A slight understatement. They age better than well. Let's talk, and I want to sort of plow through as many of the, what is there, seven chapters in the book, all the way from Robert Stein, who was the medical examiner for many years, who you really liked him, didn't you?
He was funny.
He was the coroner.
Don't
not
you
just
remember
the,
how
oh,
funny
absolutely.
He was?
Well, but I didn't, and you brought it back, and then I did. Then I did. Most of these were, well, you worked for the Tribune for a time, and then you left.
Worked for the Reader.
Why? And then you were you tired of the Tribune?
Not, well, not I belonged at the Reader. You know, I was
well,
more
was also,
like
you were a
that type of person.
Well, also at the time, in newspapers, certainly, even though the Tribune had a magazine, it was not a nurturing home to what we call long-form narrative journalism.
That's true.
And that is what is your real strength, Pat, mm-hmm. I think. And I've mm-hmm. always thought, because I remember many of these stories from the Reader. Was it a joy to write, or was it hard for you?
Oh, I think writing is always going to be, is always hard, you know? I think that it's such a big deal. I've never found it easy at all, or fast.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing I'm not on daily deadlines.
Well, no one is anymore. It's too bad you have some kind of daily blog or some weird blog news scene. You were attracted to, and certainly this book is, I hate to use the phrase, the dark side, but this is the dark side. I'm not trying to tell you that these stories are not, do not have their moments of grand, if dark humor, you're very interested and always have been in that part of humanity, haven't you?
Well, I think that theater is a lot like court. And so I liked those two things. You know, I actually did some theater criticism when I was young. And I also, but I spent a lot of time in courtrooms here because it's very dramatic. You know, it's very Shakespeare. So, yeah, that of course. That's what I enjoyed.
Let's start here with a man that I did not know but knew of, Paul Tyner. Who was Paul Tyner?
Well,
this was a comic.
He was a really great writer. He was a kind of a genius, you know, I'd say. He was a mathematician. He was a systems guy before we really had systems guys. And he was alcoholic. Yes, very alcoholic. And he wrote he used to hang with Leary Wywoody, who is still, I believe, alive and a novelist. And he and Paul both had written stories for The New Yorker that won prizes when they were quite young. And they hung out with Roger Ebert, too. They were also from the University of Illinois. And Paul became notorious on North Avenue and Lincoln Avenue. And he would get, you know, just screamingly, raving drunk.
Well,
and
you tried.
It was hilarious.
At one point in the book, I mean, you kind of tried to save him almost, did you not?
Yeah, well, I didn't even know what I was doing. Yeah. You know, I mean, I obviously knew very little about anything on Earth. And
That's probably why you survived some of these years. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was really a novice. And Paul Tyner, yeah, he ended up, he tried to kill himself or something, accidentally, maybe on purpose, I don't know. But he ended up in Grant Hospital. And they had, because they couldn't reach his family, his friends had to sit there with him because they couldn't put a private nurse on him. So I was one of the first in line, you know, for whatever reason, because everybody else was out getting drunk, probably. Like, I wasn't, you know. So I go there, and I realize he's tied to the bed. And he starts talking to me like normal, and then all of a sudden says, oh, you really like to see me like this tied up, trying to get me to untie him, which is something alcoholics do.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Well, they're incredibly, and we've known manipulative. I mean, they are, you know, that kind of alcoholic charm is not quite up there with the heroin addict charm, but it's there. You in at the end of this story, and this is one of the shorter chapters in the book. You write, you don't mind my reading from your book, because I really, I've always thought you were a terrific writer. You write, in the summer of 1983, I heard that Tyner was dead. I called the coroner in Los Gatos, California, who said that Tyner died August 9th. He had blown his head off with a heavy caliber rifle in the bathroom of his home. His two sons, who were teenagers by then, were in the next room. The coroner said he had released the body to the local undertaker, and so I called the undertaker. The undertaker said Tyner had been cremated, and he and one of his sons had scattered the ashes near the funeral home. Tyner had been a very important person, I explained to the undertaker. He had written a book and won an O. Henry Prize. He was a mathematical genius, I said. The undertaker said he was sorry. Nobody told him who Paul Tyner was. Now that, I don't mean to overcompliment you. That's just really fine, to the point writing. Do you miss it?
Oh.
These kind of, I mean, the reader doesn't do long-form narrative journalism anymore, you know?
Yeah, nobody does print, you know? I mean, it's just, well, The New Yorker does it.
Right.
There's a few.
Tough market to break into.
Yeah.
Tough market to break into. What's the reception for the book? We got a few minutes in this half hour. Rick, get on the thing. I was there accidentally at the birth of this book. I'm having lunch. Someone took me to lunch at the Cliff Dwellers, and I look across the table, and there's Rick Kampfer and Pat Callender having a talk, and that's when this deal came together, isn't it?
Yeah, it actually happened at that lunch that you were there.
Lucky and, Rick Kogan.
Yeah, that's right.
What was it about this book? Eckhart has done some remarkable things. He published novels, he published memoirs, John Landecker's, Rich King's, among others. What had you known Pat?
I had, and actually I would do absolutely anything for Pat, because Pat is the reason why I'm a writer. Because she took a chance on me when I was a radio producer and gave me an outlet, one of the magazines that she was working for, and let me write for that magazine, not knowing if I could do it or not, or having an inkling of it. And after that, you know, I would do absolutely anything for Pat.
Yeah, but this is not, you know, it's not like this book's written in crayon, man.
Well, thing, she sent me the book. So she sent me the manuscript of it, and I read it, and I was blown away.
You should have been. Good.
Blown away. And in fact, my wife was just reading it yesterday, and she said, when you see Pat, please tell her this is the best thing I've ever read. So there you go, Pat.
So it was a real no-brainer for you to publish
it. Yeah, I didn't give it a second thought.
Well, it was a no-brainer for me to publish Rick. I knew he was funny. I knew he was smart. I had met him as John Landecker's producer.
Right.
And, I mean, he had written several things. He was, you know, it's not like we paid, like, real great rates either. And Rick was, an instant star. So
that must be nice to hear, Rick Kemp.
That is. It's very nice to hear.
How's the press doing? Well?
It's doing very well. We just published our 25th book.
Wow.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In how many years?
In 5 years.
So. That's really something, because the public book publishing business, as all of us know in here, is ridiculous these days. Just ridiculous.
And anybody who buys this book really should buy it from Eckhart's, because Rick and I get about 50 cents a piece if they buy it on Amazon.
Yeah, see, so, that's the other thing. I mean, I don't think people realize it's much easier to buy books these days, but, man, the authors are not the ones making out. So, Elif, the wonderful producer, Elif Garish, will put all this stuff on the website, but you can, if you'd like to now, go to ECKHARTZPRESS.com and buy one of Pat's books and buy all the other books that Eckhart does.
They're all good.
We're going to spend this entire, the rest of the hour with Pat Colander talking about her book, Hugh Hefner's First Funeral, and we'll tell you what that means, and other true tales of love and death in Chicago. You got a guy, I mean, it's a problem at Oak Street Beach, and then you have Hugh Hefner in one of the most interesting cases in the history of this town.
It's the good life, full of fun.
Yes, it is, and Pat Colander and I lived the good life many years ago when we were young and foolish and drinking at bars and being newspaper people. She is here to talk about life in general, but also about her latest book, Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago. We just talked about Paul Tyner. I want to talk about Roger Patton, in which Oak Street Beach plays a seminal role. Who was Roger Patton, Pat?
He was a kid that was very overweight and got lost, and his family, you know, never had any money, and they lived on the north side, and they used to say that they would, you know, the wrecking ball went right behind them. They'd move from apartment to apartment. When I met them, they were on Fullerton, and the reason I met them was they contacted the Chicago Reader and wanted somebody to do a story about their sons and their dead son in particular, who had been shot by the police. And these kinds of stories happened way before Trayvon Martin, way before, but there was such a thing as suicide by police.
Well, it was also in an era when there was not the intense media, that nobody had cell phones. You know what I mean? It was easy to sweep things under a number of different rugs. And if a reporter was not hot on this trail, it would get, you know, something like this would have gotten an inch in the newspaper, if that.
Right.
He committed suicide by police. Explain what that means. I know what it means. But.
Well, what it meant with Roger Patton was he took a fake gun and pulled it out at 5 o'clock on Oak Street Beach. And the police were called, and you know, and he had a gun, they thought, and he was shot before he hurt somebody else. I mean, I can totally get this.
See, one of the things that distinguishes not only that story, but every one of the stories in Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago from Eckhart's Press, the local savior of good writing and good writers, is the depth to these stories. I mean, it's not simple. You talk to, in almost every case, as many people as you possibly can, and many of them, what struck me is the people who are closest to the victims, the protagonists, and that's a tough thing to do sometimes, isn't it, Pat?
Well, yeah, but you had to when you worked for the Chicago Reader, because nobody had ever heard of it. You know, in the 70s, you had to get out there. You couldn't interview people on the phone, which I really didn't like, still don't like.
Yeah.
You know,
you
really want to look into their face and see what they're saying to you. And people now are probably much more guarded, you know.
But see, the other thing in those, I don't know if they're more guarded or they're more open. I think, you know, shows like Phil Donahue and Oprah have made the notion of, like, being forthcoming and talk about anything. But when you're talking about these kind of details, it is a strange, do you not think, Pat Colander, a kind of dance and a kind of almost a kind of romance that you have to play with the subject to get them to open up. And when they do, however, you get remarkable stuff.
Well, some people you almost have to protect from themselves.
Good point.
They tell you too much, know, in a way.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But like in that one case in the book, I interviewed the ex-husband of the victim, and he was saying things like, "Well, I probably would have killed her if I would have stayed married to her," and you know, people say. You know, you sit there and they've never had anybody ask them those questions.
That's right.
You know,
see,
they're so on the fringes.
When I think that's the era, and when people before Facebook, when people were not sharing everything about their lives, that when they would share it with someone like you, someone who was sympathetic and also asking pointed question, it really did become something amazing. I don't want to, I'm going to get into Bobby Arnstein. That is... to my mind, one of the most fascinating characters in the history of Chicago, not because she herself was fascinating, but the world in which she lived and died was fascinating. She is the subject of Hugh Hefner's first funeral, and the reason that is the title here is, you write, Bobby Arnstein's was the first funeral Hugh Hefner remembered attending back then, quote, "I don't remember having gone to any other funeral because no close friend had ever died," Hefner explained. "I wanted to reach over and wake her up." That is a stunning, amazing quote. Who was Bobby Arnstein, Pat Callender?
She was his executive assistant and kind of got labeled as a secretary, was very sensitive about it, and she... I mean, a lot of people believe she was set up, but there was a low-level drug dealer guy, boyfriend, that, you know, that was wired up from the feds, yeah. And they nailed her on a cocaine charge, and who knows? But they were trying to get to Hugh Hefner, yes.
No question. No question. It's mid-70s, and you really do... I love your writing so much that I just used to write, ironically, by the mid-70s, some of the heady excitement of two decades of Playboy's success dissipated, and Hefner, seeking a quick romantic fix, had recently been touting himself as an ex-F. Scott Fitzgerald character as though he had forgotten the end of the story. Those were wild days. When you finally interviewed Hefner, what did you think of him? I mean, this was, for a long time, Hefner's town, the mansion on South State Street with the famous saying in Latin, if you don't swing, don't ring. He was one of the, I mean, he dominated this town like, I suppose, someone like Oprah did, right. But in a much more sexy, outlandish kind of way. What did you think of him, Pat?
I thought he was childlike, and I thought he was kind, and that's why there was an innocence about him that is rather bizarre given the circumstances. But, you know, he had become famous very quickly. He was kind of a loner type person. And I could see why Bobby kind of was attracted to him, in much more than a sexual way.
Oh, I think it was much more a kind of father-daughter kind of thing.
Right.
She looked up to him. And she's such a tragic figure. And what it did, I mean, the name immediately, you think Bobby Arnstein, cocaine, death, this. But you brought back the whole world in which she lived, which was really, really crazy. And unbelievably seductive, don't you think?
Yes, because they had money.
Yeah.
You know, and they had money to pay for writers like Paul Tyner and other people.
Yeah.
And they were the biggest game in town. On the other hand, look how they built it.
Yeah.
The book review editor at the Tribune used to say to me, who was a feminist, used to say to me, you know, I'm all for free press, but I kind of wish the Playboy building would burn to the ground. And there was that
feeling. Sure. And after the Arnstein tragedy... that's the sign of the end of Hefner in Chicago.
Well, that's right.
And that's why this This, I think the title's great, Rick Camphor, your genius at titling thing. Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago by Pat Collender. And this illustrator, David Mosell, is, I love his drawings. Who's this guy, Rick?
Actually, he worked with Pat.
See, Pat has always, she'd made you a writer,
yeah.
Ergo a publisher.
That's right.
We'll be right back.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon.
It's Count Basie and Frank Sinatra all night tonight on After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, on WGN. If Pat Collender and Rick Camphor and I have not convinced you to buy Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago, then you literally haven't been listening. It's unbelievably compelling. It is a terribly compelling stories from the somewhat dark but always interesting history of this town. We've talked about a few things. We've talked about Hugh Hefner and Bobby Arnstein, about Paul Tyner, about The Last Stand of Roger Patton, which is a tragic, tragic story. The Final Days of the Cook County Morgue is, to my mind, I hate to use the word, it's a joyous story.
It's a comedy.
Yeah, it is a comedy. That's a joyful story. You've got to be, Pat Collender, pleased with this book. I mean, does it evoke for
you?
Oh,
yeah. It was so depressing when I was doing this, but like the Stein story still makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Because he was so, you know, I can still see the whole thing. And you know, he takes me to the Rose Room to look at the Gacy remains of the Gacy victims. You know, he's taking me all around the morgue. And one of his assistants says, oh, is she doing the story of your life, Doc? And he goes, only my sex life. I mean,
yeah, he was one of the great characters in the history of this town. Do you think that it seems to me that we don't make them the way we used to? Is that, am I just an old curmudgeonly goof?
Everybody's trying to be some identity they made up.
Yeah, yeah.
For social media, I mean.
Well, I think that may indeed be part of the problem, that people's personalities are spread too thin and too, they're not sincere, because you have to spread yourself out there. When you think of people like Bruce Elliott, who is in this book, that's a genuine human being. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't like Bruce. I happen to like him a lot. You like him a lot. Everybody in the world can argue with him. Hefner's another one.
Alan Ackerman in there.
Alan Ackerman, the attorney in here.
One of the legendary defense attorneys.
Yeah, talk about him. Talk about Ackerman, because he's got his whole
chapter.
Well,
he's about 4.5 feet tall.
Right. Right.
For starters, and the way he looks, I describe in the book, but he won. And, you know, and he ended up being partners with Durkin and Egan, who I think are both judges by now.
Right, 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 right.
And quite well known. But Alan did so many of the cases that I was involved with. I mean, it was kind of like he did Richard Bailey's appeal before he went to Florida in the Helen Brock case. He's just been, you know, he's a legend.
Well, you start that chapter, and again, your writing is so perfect and to the point. As you step through the door and into the office, the only visible part of Alan Ackerman is his talking head. That is a great, as we used to call it in the business, lead. That is a great lead. Rick Camphor, you must be beyond pleased to have this among the Eckhart's Press offerings.
Yeah, I think this is our first legitimate piece of journalism that we have published. I mean, that it really is a spectacular work by
and Rick
Pat.
Says that, and Rick says that having written some and co-authored
well, so
some
I
of the
know.
Books that are in here. Yes, that's as high as the praise gets. Rick and Brendan Sullivan wrote The Living Wills. Rick collaborated with John Landecker on Records Truly Is My Middle Name. There is a, to my mind, there is, you know, I think of stories by and you'll know them, Pat, by writers no longer with us, like Bill Newman, like M.W. Newman of the Sun-Times, of the Daily News and Sun-Times. There is a, I don't know if there's a market for this, but anybody would be foolish not to have on their bookshelf Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and Other True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago. I've read you just a few paragraphs here and there, but I hope you can sense from that what a fine writer and what a fine eye Pat Colander has had in the day and still has. What's next for you? You've been a magazine. Are you just, what were the magazines? You got sort of seduced by Northeastern.
Making a living?
Don't we all? Northeastern Indiana and Southwestern Michigan, and you know, published some, ran some magazines up there. And you like being a boss?
No.
Yeah.
No. I could not make a living as a writer, really, even if you worked at the Chicago Tribune. I mean, it was just wasn't a viable career by the time I got there.
Right.
And so I decided I had to cross into the business side when I was, I don't know, in my 40, by I was about 40.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had kids that had to go to college. I had stuff. So that's why I crossed into management. And it was at the time that they really needed some women in management.
No question.
In the newspaper business and print journal, print everything.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky in a lot of ways. And so I rode the wave.
Well, but you've also had, starting in the business when you did, you've had an admirable career that could be, I know the business has changed, it's chaotic now, but I mean, a really admirable career being, you know, among the handful of women who worked for newspapers in the late 60s and early 70s, and then writing long form pieces for the Reader, and then running magazines, and now this is a culmination of sorts. You have more stories, do you
not?
Yeah,
I have stuff I want to do. I have things I want to write about.
And there should be. I mean, there's movie material in here, Rick. How good are you at doing that stuff, Rick Camphor? I'm not asking you to make movies.
I know what she's working on next, and that's going to be even better. That's all I can say.
Okay.
It's a top secret project right now.
Well, you were saying, and I'm not going to embarrass them, but you brought your kids to Pat's book signing at the Old Town Ale House where they have some...
Yes.
Where they have some paintings on the walls by Bruce Elliott that embarrass me.
Yeah.
They embarrass me, some of those paintings.
I brought my 13-year-old who tapped me on the shoulder and he said,
"Dad, could you buy that one for me? I'd like that in my bedroom."
Yeah.
I'd like, is that Newt Gingrich, Dad?
What is Mitt Romney doing with his underwear right there?
What is he doing?
Yeah.
Why is that man in a prison cell? Pat, it's an ongoing pleasure to know you, and it's ever been a pleasure to read you. And this thing is, I'll read another jacket quote for you. Tim Kazurinsky, who I like tremendously. Tim was a Saturday Night Live guy. He and Denise DeClue collaborated on the screenplay for David Mamet's, for the show based on Sexual Perversity in Chicago, a movie called About Last Night. Tim says, as Paul Simon bookended, time it was, and what a time it was, a time of innocence, a time of confidences. Chicago in the 70s was surreal, scary, and freaking hilarious. Denise DeClue writes, Pat Colander toiled with me in the belly of the Chicago journalism beast in the 70s and 80s. She found the real stories behind the stories, and this collection of her work is just great. She ought to be long listed for the Man Booker Prize. If I can figure out how to do it, I will. Then again, we have the Bruce Elliott kind of very modest quote, the stories age well. Again, the book is Hugh Hefner's First Funeral and True Tales of Love and Death in Chicago. It captures a time... And some of the characters who existed and kind of, in a sense, blew themselves up in that time. But here again is a portion of Ms. Colander's philosophy. Treating a person as though he or she is invisible or inferior is unacceptable behavior in human beings. She has plumbed the depths of human beings in this book and brought them to amazing, amazing life. Thanks for coming in. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Rick, to your wife, who thinks that Pat Collender's book is the best book she's ever read. Is that what she said?
That's what she said, yeah.
That's pretty good. And she's read all of the other offerings.
She has.
It's better than your book, honey. I guess I can say this on Mother's Day. It's better than your book. Thank you both for coming, and happy Mother's Day to you, Pat.
Thank you, Rick.
It's good to see you again. It's really good. It's really good to see you. Coming up, my buddies Dot Coyle and Mary Beth Hare, they own a place called Coyle and Hare, which sells consignment stuff, and they now have a ton of stuff from the estate of the late Lois Weisberg. And Lois Weisberg had astonishing taste, so we will plumb the depths. And they were both friends of Lois's, too, and I can ramble on about Lois. So please stay tuned. You'll hear some more Sinatra and Count Basie and whatever. If you haven't celebrated Mother's Day, it's getting late. It's really getting late. If you haven't celebrated, go have a drink or whatever it is. My mom's my mom, who is long gone. But she had, you know, my mother lived till 88 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a durable Irish broad, as they say.